This is Alex Peace of EG doing the EG Longform podcast, and this week we're looking at the government's shake-up of the National Planning Policy Framework, or the NPPF. A very well-briefed national press in advance focused on use-it-or-lose-it powers, increased build-out, and an end to land banking. But did the self-proclaimed largest shake-up of the planning system in the last 6 years really have any teeth? I have here with me in the EG office four experts of the planning world to give a hopefully simplified and certainly on-point view of what was in it and what the industry needs to know. In no particular order, I'm joined by Ian Fletcher, Director of Real Estate Policy at the BPF, Philip Barnes, Group Land and Planning Director at Barratt Development, Jonathan Stoddart, Head of London Planning at CBRE, and Ian Painting, Partner at Barton Willmore. Chaps, thank you all very, very much for coming to join me. As I say, the aim of this particular podcast is to just get the expert views on what the NPPF means and what it means for you chaps and your specialities in particular. So, in one sentence, as straightforwardly as possible, I guess, was there anything in the revised document or the associated releases that came with it, because there's quite a lot out there, that came as a surprise? Jonathan, should we start with you?
I wouldn't say there are any surprises in it. I think we, from the working back to the white paper and the various other mechanisms, I think this draft NPPF has been fairly well roadmarked along the way.
Ian, from your own perspective?
Again, no real surprises. I was surprised, I suppose, by some of the emphasis, and particularly on land banking. And I'd taken that really as being political theatre, and in that having a number of measures in there that local authorities will not like. The PM was trying to provide balance in terms of also giving the development community a bit of a sort of kick up the backside as well. So overall, I think more politics than necessarily hard measures there.
Philip, you're the development community.
I'd agree with Ian. I didn't think there was any major surprises, but the emphasis was, I think in Barratt we feel, is quite positive. And as an example, I think we were quite surprised to see such strong support for brownfield sites, in particular where they're allocated for employment, and also in Greenbelt, where we'll no longer hidebound by the requirement when delivering on brownfield in Greenbelt to be restricted to the height and the floor space and the volume of the existing buildings. The test now is just no substantial harm, which I think Barratt is viewing quite positively as a potential source of supply.
Well, we're going to get on to brownfield and greenfield and changes to the development. Ian, finally, your own perspective on it?
No, I think we live in a world whereby things are trailed now much, and then when it's finally actually released, we all think, oh yes, we actually knew that was. The issue actually probably is what's actually in the nuances of it as well, and how they hang, as it were. Jobs and growth, very silent, I would say. And I was surprised there wasn't more on that, and more on infrastructure, etc., and how that drives jobs and housing as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, moving on from that then, what was in it that you thought was the most important thing? What, from your particular specialities, so Ian from the PRS, Philip as a developer, what was in there that you really did actually care about? Go ahead, Ian.
The thing that I was passionate about is actually not to do with the build to rent, but following through with the standardised assessment of housing need and the associated housing delivery test, and sticking to their guns on that. I think very brave of a government to be taking on, particularly sort of Tory shires and districts. Certainly, I know that a number of them hate this policy, and for government to be saying, almost, they won't call them targets, but here are the numbers you've got to deliver on, I think is something that we should strongly get behind, because ultimately that is the most important game in town in terms of delivering numbers.
All right, hands up. Who wants to explain very, very simply what the housing delivery test is, what was changed, and what is there not to like from local authorities, but to like from the perspective of everyone else? We've got a stone silence in the room. Come on, who wants to explain this? You've all had 3 days now to go through the changes.
Ultimately, there's a sort of ratchet up of the housing delivery test over time. I think it's by 2020, if you're not delivering 75% of your housing need, then effectively the government can sort of ride in and override your local plan. The presumption in favour of sustainable development applies. So yeah, there is some incentive there to ensure that A, you've got a local plan in place, and B, that you are meeting the numbers. The numbers are not sort of manufactured numbers that local authorities want to set out themselves, but numbers that are determined at a to large extent at national level, and therefore some of the districts, certainly that surround London, who have not really got close to their housing need for a number of years, in particular, I think will find this very challenging, but quite right to do so.
Yeah, just to butt in there, I mean, I think what's interesting on the background paper, it's a three-year test. It's averaged over the 3 years, and that's a change in my world. I don't know what Philip thinks, in that 5 years still appears, but increasingly now housing land supply will be assessed on a three-year basis. And that, I think, is a change. Whether it's good or bad depends where you are in that cycle, as it were. And also there's a conversation here to be had as to whether those thresholds are right. Set a bit too low, perhaps. Should be higher. But the codifying of the test is good, isn't it, in principle?
I think from a Barratt perspective, I'd agree with Ian. It's something that's very welcome. We think it will make a difference. And in terms of the nuts and bolts, what it means is that if a local authority hasn't built enough, looking backwards against its local plan targets, it's going to have a presumption in favour of development imposed on it. Whereas I've always been used to a world where a local authority could just say, well, we've got this many sites consented, and therefore I've got enough supply, so I don't have to release additional sites. So for us, you know, we know the areas where there might be a huge long tail of consents, particularly on big sites, but they're not actually delivering houses. Well, we know where those areas are, and if they're not delivering houses, looking backwards, we know where they are, and we're going to target our land buying on those areas in a way we wouldn't have done previously because of that long tail of consents.
I mean, getting more into the nitty-gritty here, this presumption in favour of development, will that actually make any difference? Will any developer realistically start just buying a site knowing that that local plan hasn't been met, or the housing need hasn't been met, and thus will buy a site knowing I will be able to just get going without the local authority's approval?
Well, again, from a Barratt perspective, it will make a difference. We will, we look at the areas that don't have a five-year land supply. We have done since MPPF came in 2012, and now you're seeing 300,000 consents a year compared to about 110,000 in 2012. So that presumption in favour, looking forwards against supply, has had an impact. This will drive that even further forward.
I mean, I think you need to look at how this translates into letters, Secretary of State letters and appeals, etc., and how this is now addressed, if it comes through over summer, because that's the real test, isn't it? How it's applied by inspectors on appeal. And if there's a track record of that in the next 6 months, say, after it's adopted and published, that I think will add even more strength to it.
Well, the next follow-on from this, of course, is the use-it-or-lose-it powers, or the sort of increasing the speed of build-out. So who's got the opening opinion on this, I suppose? Were there actually any teeth in this? Because this was one of the Prime Minister's favourite things to be talking about. But realistically, is there anything in there which is going to increase the speed of build-out? And not just from a stick perspective, but from a carrot perspective too. Philip, what about yourselves?
You're absolutely right. There isn't an awful lot in it. And of course, there can't be, because Oliver Letwin is currently doing a review on that very issue. And we couldn't expect a draft document to come out with formal policy in advance of an important piece of evidence base. We expect the review to highlight the huge delays caused by pre-commencement conditions. And Barratt's done some research which says that on average it takes 21 months from getting consent to starting on site. Now that needs to be addressed, and we're hoping Letwin will look at that. I think on Monday, I thought Theresa May's speech was perhaps more interesting than the document itself, in saying that she wanted to get land directly from the landowner to the builder quicker. And it will be good to see what Letwin says about that.
Jonathan, from a central London perspective, or a London perspective, what kind of measures could be put in place to actually increase build-out faster, or what could be removed from a planning perspective to increase build-out?
It seems to be a lot of the threat of a stick. And I think one of the only things in there is the sort of in the MPPF is less than 3 years planning permission, as if that would encourage house builders to get on and develop. And I think that that sort of misses the point. It's incredibly expensive to make planning applications, and I think, and Philip's gladly nodding, very expensive. You spend millions of pounds getting your planning permission, and I think it would be very rash to issue a 1 year, 2 year planning permission. I don't think that's necessarily the problem. It is linked to the pre-commencement conditions and the very onerous conditions that you have to go through once you've got your planning permission. I think, I mean, and this might be slightly controversial, but I think in terms of carrots, that doesn't seem to be looked at. And I think I'd love to see some form of mechanism of, I don't know, a ratchet sill effect, that sill would be increased year on year that you're not building. And so in the first year, there would be more of an incentive to build out. And certainly just those types of ideas of financially rewarding developers to just be encouraged to get on with things. I think in terms of, I think house builders in the press have taken a bit of a pasting for sitting on these sites rather unfairly. And I think if you were, it's a horrible management technique to say, right, we need house builders to build. Let's basically criticise them, openly criticise them. What about encouragement? And I don't see that sort of encouragement at the moment.
So CBRE's clearly got a very encouraging policy. Ian, any views on this as well?
Yes, it's interesting, wasn't it, to have this comment of use it or lose it, and it was trailed that you take into account the track record of the applicant when granting approval, as it were. Now, it's a central part of planning, isn't it, that the personal circumstances of the applicant, they seldom are material. That's fundamental. You don't have to own land to make a scheme, bring forward a scheme, as it were. To go down the way the sound bites have gone would be a fundamental change, as it were, and I don't think they can go there. Paragraph 78 just shows how sad I am. It has an interesting line at the very end sentence, which says, for major housing development, local planning authorities should also assess why an earlier grant of planning permission for a similar development on the same site did not start. That is interesting. That's a fundamental question. And I think on a complicated site, and we all act on difficult sites, where there's often some major issue that's holding back the scheme, if that paragraph, that sentence, is a platform for a conversation to say, I am stuck because of A, B or C. Help me. Intervene with me through HIF funding, etc., to unlock this. Then that actually is a good way forward. Just saying, I'm going to give you a 2 year consent or 1 year consent, it won't actually work. And I think we've been there before, actually. And it won't actually bring four sites faster. And sadly, will probably act against the larger sites, the more complicated sites, that often deliver the wider range of gains, as it were, as well.
Just picking up on that, there's an excellent point. Just at the start of that the track record piece. I mean, again, more of a focus on London at the moment. But we are acting for a number of foreign investment companies who are coming up and buying huge chunks of London with the intention of delivering large scale development. Are we going to try and put those off at a time when we've got Brexit and all sorts of world problems? Do we want to try and discourage them by saying, well, you haven't delivered in this country before, you can't come in? It doesn't really stack up.
One of the lines which I found, and I certainly can't quote the paragraph in there, no need for viability assessments if schemes meet affordability and local authority criteria. I mean, shouldn't that technically already be a presumption within planning anyway? Does that make any difference at all? Is that going to speed things up? Who wants to start?
Well, there's people in the room who know more about the details of the London planning system than I do, but I'm taking this to have really come from the mayoral policy that if you deliver 35%, you don't have to go through the viability testing. And Barrett supported that. And if that principle rolls out, which I think is what this is about, then I don't think we would have a major problem as long as the local authorities are realistic in their requirements and the policies are sufficiently flexible. So I don't see that as a major problem, provided the policies are okay. Only less than 20% of our sites end up in a viability dispute for the reason you said, Alex. We try to buy them, we understand what the policies are, we buy them, we deliver those policies, and we don't end up in a dispute.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Increasingly, more and more schemes come with a viab with it, as it were. What paragraph 58 actually says is where they accord with all the relevant policies. So in a way, it's doomed for failure already, because a council is saying, sorry, your bin stores don't quite meet the standard. Or you fail one policy, therefore we want a VIAP. What it should say is, where you accord with land use and affordable housing policies, you do not need to do a VIAP. And that would be very, very good and very, very clear.
Absolutely. I can't think of many schemes that have been absolutely policy compliant across the board. And frankly, we wouldn't be doing our jobs if we just said it was absolutely in compliance. And so that's a very good point.
Well, this was another one of the associated documents that came out of it, which was talking about a sort of nationally set developer contribution level, or a nationally set SIL or 106. Right, that sounds great in practice because everyone knows where they are, what they're meant to be doing. But I mean, nationally set, it varies quite a lot across the UK, not just from London to the rest, but also just across London. What are the views on a sort of national developer contribution? Should that be allowed, or actually should there be room for negotiation, even if it does take a bit longer?
We had the challenge of this issue when we were in discussions with the department over the last couple of years in terms of the support for build to rent. There was a suggestion in the white paper that if you were delivering 20% of the housing as affordable at 20% or less of market rents, then you would be meeting a sort of national criteria. The difficulty that causes is that certainly in a number of areas north of Watford, they often don't need any affordable housing requirement. And so how do you give, I suppose, certainty in the south whilst not putting in policy something that might inhibit development in the north? And so yes, I think it is quite a challenge to be able to have a national policy that would tackle that sort of issue.
So the standard problem of planning, it would be lovely to have clarity, but then again, every scheme still also needs negotiation and it varies on its own merits. A lot of Sadiq Khan's policies with the GLA, and since he's come into power, for instance, 35% viability, 35% affordable levels, fast-tracking viability in that case, seem to be being looked at now at a national level as fast-tracking that, not to mention also the sort of multiple tenures approach. Is that really happening, and is that a good thing, actually, at the national level?
We are seeing a lot of... the step change has been across London is when sites are now being purchased, they are factoring in the 35% affordable housing, and so that is factored into the land value when they purchase it. So to all intents and purposes, it's working. I think where you've got the problem and where developers are accused of being sat on sites is when they purchased it a number of years ago and for various reasons couldn't bring it forward. That could be wholly viability-led, that could be tenancies, occupation of sites, all sorts of things. And it's those sites that you almost felt that should have had a holiday and gone through the previous regime of viability and worked it out from there, because those sites are the ones that have the biggest challenges. But certainly, the fixed 35% is certainly having an impact, and it is working. And think that it's a good idea.
Ian, your views?
I mean, there's a fundamental point here, isn't there, and which I've raised in the past, which is, what is the underlying approach? Is it to tax schemes within an inch of not working to get the maximum amount of money at all points in time? Or is it to levy a base level, based on a regional level and house prices, perhaps, so to say? That may not be the maximum that you could achieve, but is certain, and actually more and more schemes pay into the pot, as it were. At the moment, I'd say the approach is the former, and it varies across different places. But there is a view, I'd say, that property development is seen as a soft tax. It's seen as a way of levying more and more money, as it were. Still hasn't worked, and the disappointing thing, I think, of all the paperwork which has come out, the government haven't grappled with SIL. And I think if you want to increase the rate of delivery, improve the viability of schemes, SIL needs a major overhaul, in my view.
I think, Alex, you make a good point about some policies feeling as though they're piloted in London and then being driven out. And one of the ones for me is the recommendation that existing use value plus is now the way to set a benchmark land value being embedded into MPPF. Now, I know that's very, very detailed and geeky.
I have no idea what you're talking about, so we're going to have to really simplify it for me, basically.
Well, what it means is, you, in a nutshell, you can value land based on what its existing use is. And that might work okay in London. I'm not sure it actually would, but it might work okay-ish. But outside of London, I think that could be tricky for many landowners. And the test in the old MPPF was, as long as you had a willing landowner, that would, you could have a viability negotiation. But now the test is you have to have a rational landowner. And I think where you've got planners deciding what is and isn't rational, I think there could be some negotiations there that hitherto hadn't happened.
I think it trying to make it as firm as you can, you lose some of the, I think developments are seen by the general public as an evil, I think, a lot of the time, as something that you have to tax because, well, the developer's making so much money, you're taxing them. And I think what development isn't seen in is the UK, and it's such a shame because we've got some, you know, I think brilliant examples. Development actually solves a lot of problems. And, you know, I've been involved and I've seen various schemes that have provided first-class schooling, new schools, all these sorts of things that really help areas. And if you have a very prescriptive way of dealing with community infrastructure levy and Section 106, you can kill those types of schemes that actually solve a lot of problems. There are shortages of, sticking with the school theme, there are areas where, you know, they've got crippling school problems and a developer can come along and deliver a school. Now, would you want to tax them with a life of not doing that? Then I think that you lose a certain art of development, and I think that would be a shame.
Ian, go ahead.
The big issue that I come up against by communities is, what does it do for me? Are you just dumping these houses on us, as it were? And I like to say that my client will often make this himself or herself. I will deliver for you the schools. I will deliver for you the new doctor's surgeries. Unfortunately, the way the seal world works, it takes away your ability to talk to that community, listen to them, and shape your scheme to actually meet that need. And there's a miss, you're absolutely right, John. There's this view that development just imposes itself, rather than development can be a great change, can actually create change and actually take things forward, as it were. And I think that needs to be worked through much more in here, and actually be picked up as well.
I'd agree with that in terms of, I think, ultimately SIL was there to pay for the infrastructure. We seem to have sort of lost that a bit in all the discussions that have been taking place in terms of the sort of finite detail of how it works. But ultimately, it's there to deliver the infrastructure that will facilitate the development and get the community on side. It was interesting, I think, on the morning of the launch of the NPPF, that there was a letter went in from, I think, from six industry bodies, just sort of reminding the wider world that we do need that infrastructure there if we're to get the housing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, moving on from SIL and contributions, Greenbelt was in there. This happens every time there's anything involving planning. Everyone hopes there'll be Greenbelt relaxations, etc., etc. So what's really happened about the Greenbelt? Some of the wording seemed to be a little stricter. Good or bad? Philip, your perspective?
We welcome it because it's providing clearer guidance on the circumstances where Greenbelt can or cannot be released. It's actually defining what exceptional circumstances exist where Greenbelt can be developed on. And as a house builder, we prefer, on an issue like that, we prefer that clarity, because we know where, using that guidance, where there isn't enough brownfield land, where there isn't enough scope to meet numbers just through increasing density, and where there's scope to have compensatory improvements. And we'll look at those areas, and where those circumstances aren't in place, we won't look at them. So it takes away that kind of gaming and speculation about where or where not Greenbelt release might happen.
Mm-hmm. Ian?
I think as drafted, it almost begins to introduce a sequential test. It actually codifies the actual approach, which is good.
What does that mean?
Well, you actually go through a stepped process now. We all know there are special circumstances, etc. We all know, and there's case law on that, etc. What this does now is drafted, it takes the council and us through certain steps to prove the case. And that's good. There's a fundamental gap, though, in it, which I would say, is that if you look at the standard method for calculating housing need with the cap. The upshot of that is 45% of the national need on that new method is in London and the wider South East, which is the Green Belt as well. So you've got a continued statement of intent on the Green Belt, yet the evidence exponentially is placing the need exponentially high precisely in the areas of the Green Belt, London and the wider South East, and therefore there's a gap in that.
And just moving that on a step, I like the sort of sequential analogy for it, and that feels right. But I think in when Theresa May launched this, she said it's been too easy for local authorities just to release chunks of greenbelt through their local plan. I haven't really lived and breathed that. I think it's been quite complicated to do, and I think we've been going through a similar process already. I think fundamentally with this document, it's how it's applied. And I think, you know, when they were talking about plan making, so greenbelt, really, I think they have slightly firmed up on it. I think there is a nice link with some brownfield land, and Philip touched on that earlier. I think that where they really need to step in a little bit more is they talked about, I think there's 15 local authorities on the naughty step for not delivering on their plans, and they were supposed to step in and take over that and make sure those plans went ahead. Now, I think those councils have probably been through that, broadly, that sequential test and come up with their greenbelt sites, and they're going to release them. So it always seems to be a reason why they don't publish the next step of their plan and all this sort of stuff. And the government were firm. They were going to step in and they were going to take on these plans and get them adopted. That hasn't happened. And I think, you know, when you're talking about releasing greenbelt sites through plan-led, that's fine. We get that. That seems pretty sensible and reasonable. But if councils do sit on their plans and don't get on with things, will the government actually act on what it's been saying? Or is it all just rhetoric?
I think that's just a case, perhaps, of timing there, that the local authorities had until the 31st of January to respond in letter to the Secretary of State setting out why they were not meeting their local plans. And so one presumes there will be an announcement in the course of time. I was at the speech in Bristol that the Secretary of State made setting out those 15 local authorities, and he certainly came across as being fairly intent so that he would follow through on those. So let's hope he does.
The alternative proposed by government, and actually this is the same as Khan in the London plan, was densification. There's some very vague wording in there from my interpretation. Does anyone think there's actually any wording in there which indicates you can get densification through more easily on schemes, or if this is a sort of vague hope just pitched out there by the government?
Ian, go ahead.
The answer is no, because it's caveated by character or the area, etc. What's interesting, and I am the geek of the day, paragraph 123, there you go, is that it talks about plans having densities, minimum densities, relating to public transport. That's exactly what the mayor has just removed from the draft London plan. I'm a big fan of that table, not because I stick to it, but it gives me a starting point. And I think this is welcomed in here, and it would give me a starting point for a conversation. It signals that would require a change in the character of the area. But lo and behold, on the battleground of individual small-scale schemes with a local residence group saying change of the character of my area, it's going to be very hard to make the step change in numbers.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think major conurbations are, densifying. They are, I think everyone's getting their heads around that we need to go up. I think when you look outside of those major conurbations, there is paragraph 123. In paragraph 123, there is that get-out clause of unless it's inappropriate. And I think once you get outside of the major urban areas, you can see lots of lovely market towns, but the amount of conservation areas and heritage assets that we have in the UK, you can flip that policy quite easily the other way, or that paragraph, beg your pardon, the other way, and demonstrate why it's inappropriate and the impact that we would have. So it's one of those that I'm not sure that's got particular teeth to it.
I think there's probably a pattern developing that, again, I think Barrett are a bit more positive about that. Not necessarily against this idea that existing urban areas are going to be made an awful lot denser, but that general narrative about density, we're positive about that. We buy a lot of sites with outline planning permission, And we'd like, you know, might be 200 units, and we'd like to build 230. We'd like to build 240. It's a big market for younger, smaller families, particularly in the provinces, and we want to meet that market. And yet we go to the council and say, well, the person who got the permission, this is what it's for, you can't have any more. We see this narrative playing into us, saying, no, we want 230 on the site, and policy supports that. At the moment, we just go to site on 200 because we don't want the risk and the delay. This could, and you know, politically, it's easier to put 50 houses on a site already consented for 200 than it is to release another one for 50 units, we think.
Yeah. I mean, there's 2 points on that. Philip's absolutely right. In the balance, the planning committee should say to themselves, okay, this is a bit above what we've seen in the past, but if we can deliver another 50, another 100, that's good, because it saves the need elsewhere, or it meets the needs from elsewhere, as it were. It can play both ways, because paragraph subsection C of that signals, I think for the first time, that councils should be looking to refuse permission if you don't make best use of that land. Mm. So the challenge comes back at us, which is right, I think, because, and I think as industry, we do optimise the use of land, generally, and I think that there is a Philip shaking his head on that.
I'll go and
agree. And I think, you know, but most of all the schemes I've worked on, I've generally been above the density standards pertaining in the plan. We generally look to new types of houses and new methods to see how we can optimise that site, as it were. I'm sure as you move away from London and the South East, maybe it's a different answer, Philip, and I'll take your point on that. And it may be a value point here as well, and this is the affordability point. If you go right to the very, very back of this question, the housing crisis, it's about delivering more homes for more people that people can afford to buy. And you know, space costs. And if we can optimise the density, be flexible on standards, and build a high quality product, that is what this is what we should be trying to actually do here.
Yeah, we're seeing too many sites that have been put to us to buy with consents for 3-4 bed houses. And do you know what? We'd rather build more smaller products for younger families, help them get them on the ladder. And you know, this will help us, we think. But I take your point entirely about London.
Of course, it's not all for buying. There were certain words in the policy that, or in the MPPF, which encouraged renting or other tenures. May and her government generally have been friends of this, although not sure of the new housing minister's perspective on this yet. Ian, from your, with your PRS hat on, yay, nay?
There was, I suppose, 3 or 4 mentions of build-to-rent policy within the new framework. It's easy to forget how much government policies evolved in 18 months from a sort of fairly zealotless sort of approach to starter homes through to very much a multi-tenure approach. I actually see multi-tenure featuring strongly as part of Letwin's review. I think he's bought into that argument that if you want to develop out particularly big sites, then because of absorption rates of sales, you're not going to be able to do that just with a sort of a full sale model. In terms of the MPPF itself, to some extent, national policy is sort of catching up with local policy. It sort of codifies a number of things that a number of local authorities have already been doing in terms of recognising affordable PRS as the sort of go-to affordable housing product on a build-to-rent development, recognising the definition of BTR within there, stepping back from forcing build-to-rent developments to have an element of for sale units on their sites, which is a hark back to the Starter Homes policy. Yeah. And hopefully a lot to come in terms of the associated best practice guidance, which we're told should be out sometime this week. We'll go into a lot of the detail of the government's BTR planning policies.
Mm-hmm. Right, I'm aware we're running out of time. Two things, really. The Letwin review at the end of this year seems to have quite a lot of pressure being put on it, basically, to actually come forward with some new ideas. So what are your perspectives on that? What would you like to say to Mr. Letwin before he concludes his review? And then any final thoughts from each of you as well about what was most important in the plan, what was missed maybe, what just struck you about what came out on Monday, basically. Jonathan, why don't you crack off with your views towards Mr. Letwin?
I think it's timing-wise is going to be interesting, because I think obviously you've got the draft. I think they are. It will be fascinating to see what Letwin comes up with, because I think that will have a major implication on what the final MPPF will look like. So I think it's just more a case of, great, we've got a draft here, but it's conceivable that this could change quite a bit, and whatever the outcome might be from that Letwin report.
Ian?
We've met him. He seems to be taking a very sensible approach to the review at this stage. Doesn't have, I don't think, too many sort of preconceived ideas. Is evidence collecting. Is going to issue, I believe, an interim report around about May time, which will set out his sort of initial findings, directions of travel, and then I presume around about budget in November of this year, we will get the sort of final policies coming through.
Ian?
I'll answer the what's missing point, which is jobs, infrastructure. And it's a housing-focused changes. That's right, housing crisis, understand that. Jobs are essential as well. And the relationship between jobs and infrastructure and housing needs to be addressed. And there's some fundamental changes coming our way, and the MPPF should provide that a platform to how you take forward.
Philip?
I mentioned already the importance of pre-commencement conditions. We don't land bank, we don't delay, we're a return on capital business, everyone is under massive pressure to go as fast as they can. So I'm hopefully that Letwin will look at the precise mechanics of the process and where savings can be achieved. But when I look at the amount of extra cost and effort and resource this week to try and make up the delays caused by Beast from the East last week, it confirmed in my mind more than ever, we are not a business that delays. We're a business that goes as fast as we can.
Jonathan, a final thought?
A final thought. I think there's a lot of things in there on the local plan and putting a lot back onto local authorities. 5-year reviews of plans, action plans that you've got to put together if you're not delivering, statements of common ground with your neighbouring local authorities, all good stuff, but that takes a huge amount of resource. And I think for this to be effective, I think the government needs to start resourcing planning departments much better, both on development control side and the plan making. Otherwise, this just will not be effective.
Agreed.
Well, we can't have a chat about planning without under-resourced planning departments. All, thank you ever so much for coming in.